We are pleased to inform you that you have a place at Potterversity.
Welcome to Potterversity. This is episode 30, part one of Calling In from the Harry Potter Academic Conference. Thanks for joining us at Potterversity. Today, Emily Strand and I will talk with Laurie Beckoff, Lauren Camacci, Louise Freeman, and Lana Whited about the 2022 Harry Potter Academic Conference at Chestnut Hill College. I am Katie McDaniel, Professor of History at Marietta College in Marietta, Ohio, and co-editor of Harry Potter for Nerds 2.
And I am Emily Strand, Instructor of Comparative Religions and Cultural Competency at Mount Carmel College, and author of several Harry Potter essays.
Today, Emily and I are talking with some of our regular HPAC conference attenders and presenters about the scholarship on display at Chestnut Hill College this year. Emily, the conference was hybrid again this year. In each session, there was a set of panels delivered online, which if you were in person, you could see in one room. And in the other main room, they were delivered in person, but there was a video feed to people who were in the online universe to watch them. How did you manage your decisions about where to go and, you know, whether to watch online presentations or in person?
Well, I hope my answer is not offensive to anyone who presented online, because I really like that there is an online component to the conference, because it broadens, you know, the net of that the conference can cast for mm-hmm. people who want to present. But I just found myself prioritizing the in-person talks, because I think this is probably, you know, post-traumatic pandemic stress, you know. I feel like I zone out when I'm watching somebody present in a pre-recorded way. And honestly, I was kind of bummed about my own reaction in that, because I saw a couple on the virtual list that I really wanted to see, but I didn't. So I'm hoping that those will be made available at some point and I can put one on while I'm sewing or ironing or
right. I have to admit, that was part of why I tended to go to the in-person ones, because mm-hmm. I thought, you know, hopefully the others will be available online. And I think a lot of the people at the online section were also like, hopefully the in-person ones will be made available and we can see them later. Now right. I'm just going to call on Lauren Camacci. She was online in the conference and sort of actually moderated a lot of aspects of that. Did you find that worked well for the online participants?
I think we had all of the same problems that you get with any kind of online meeting. The biggest issue we had, because I got overwhelming amounts of gratitude and praise from people saying how much they appreciated there being the online component still, because mm-hmm. even though we are one of the more affordable conferences anyone ever is going to go to in terms of academic conferences at a $15 ticket, some folks still, it's a major expense to get out here. You know, we have a couple people from out in California, some folks from down south. It was a bit hard to get to Philadelphia. Even I couldn't get to Philadelphia this year from Ohio. But we definitely need to try to work on reminding people that they need to take their Q&A from a place with a stable internet connection so that we cannot lose lose the live participation in that way. We did have to get Hannah Yano, who is also on the the editorial board and I had to get a little creative with our moderating when internet connections went out. But the presentations, I mean, we've kind of become a little old hat at doing this online thing. I mean, old hat in that we have a sort of planned fire drill we can execute every year. Karen and Patrick, the two conference chairs, and Dawn and Greg are two magical technology wizards. So we've kind of got it down to a more of a science than the absolute mission control that it was in 2020 and the mm-hmm. kind of chicken run that it was last year, for sure.
Right. Yeah. And I think one of the things that's interesting is that as I get farther away from 2020, my own remembering of the things like, oh yeah, that's right, it would be helpful to have a stable internet connection. That does, yeah. Like, that's definitely something that I have very quickly forgotten. So, but right. Yeah, I thought it was really good for accessibility to have the online. So I agree with both of you, Lauren and Emily, about that. So today we are joined in our conversation by Potterversity producer, Lori Beckoff. Also joining us are Louise Freeman and Lana Whited, who attended in person and presented in some special areas of the conference, which we are going to talk about during the show. So first, let me say how wonderful it was to see all of you this year. You too, Lauren, on the screen. It's yes, nice to ma'am. See you all. I think things are starting to feel more normal, but normal in a new way, right? As we're incorporating some of the things we learned about online presentation, you know, to try to keep the good aspects of that. All right, Potter friends, we're going to get right to it. I want to hear, what were some of your favorite talks at this year's Harry Potter Academic Conference? Lana, why don't you start us off?
Thanks, Katie. I was delighted to be there again in person. I had only attended once before, actually, in person.
Really?
So I've been really excited about this. And I want to focus on two presentations I heard that really stayed with me. You know, typically I tend to focus on the presentations that give me a lot of interesting academic ideas, and I end up looking a lot of things up and going down rabbit holes. And this year, the presentations that really have stayed with me were the ones that I connected with more emotionally, I would even say spiritually, maybe. And those two are Loretta Ross's talk, Calling In, Not Calling Out, and Patrick McCauley's presentation, The Last Enemy.
Both those are on my list too. Mm-hmm.
The presentation of death in the Harry Potter series. And I'll say a little bit about each of those. I really found that what Loretta Ross said resonated with me, especially in terms of the divisiveness that has characterized our society for the last few years. I live in a county that unfortunately has a big Trump store that has drawn some national media interest. And I, you know, try to go different ways rather than passing it when I go places. But, you know, I think we've been in an era that has been really contentious and characterized by conflict. Loretta Ross talked about the fact that bad actors are a lot more motivated by conflict than they are by unity. And I think that's definitely true and not something I needed her to say to me. But she said really early in our talk, when we call each other out, we're doing it in the wrong way. And I've been thinking a lot about that. It wasn't just a condemnation of calling other people out, but really of how we approach other people when we have conflict and disagreement. She outlined what she called the five C's, calling out, canceling, calling in, calling on, and calling off. But she seemed to me to focus a lot on this idea about calling in. And she said that calling in is a statement of who we are, not who anybody else is. And that made me think about all the conversations that I've had with others before and thought about in terms of the fact that the only reactions we really control in life are our own. I think about that a lot because I do live in a community where, you know, I work on an academic campus, but there are a lot of people in the community whose political and cultural views are very different from mine. I've spent quite a bit of time thinking about how to talk with them about topics that I know we disagree on. Loretta Ross drew a lot of examples from transphobia and white supremacy. I'm a lesbian. I have two sons who were born in Africa, so my family is an interracial family. And, you know, it strikes me, even though I do live in a community where people are very, very different, I've never personally experienced what I would characterize as prejudice in this community. I mean, people seem to interact with each other primarily based on values of care and concern. And, you know, even in my church community, where there are a lot of people like me and also other people whose families have lived in the community all their lives, again, whose values are really different. It really struck me toward the end of the presentation when Loretta Ross said, don't conflate identity and etiology. I think we tend to do that a lot. I really thought to myself about how hard it is to try to separate those two things. She made the point that no human being is dispensable. And I think in all areas of the political spectrum, sometimes we tend to become so frustrated toward other people that we probably do see them as dispensable or at least of different worth, maybe, from the people that we agree with.
Right. We stop thinking of them as human beings and think of them as idea systems or obstacles or something. Yeah. I also found that talk to be really inspiring. And I've told Emily at the conference, I was like, that was kind of like going to church in the way that, you know, sometimes church,
yes,
you go to church and you feel you are told things that you do not want to have to think about and really incorporate into your life. And it was like, oh, I'm going to have to be thinking about this for a while.
Well, I absolutely agree. And I also, you know, that presentation ended and I even said to somebody, I think Loretta Ross's soul is a lot more expansive than mine is. You know, I think my soul is going to have to expand to incorporate some of those ideas, but I think I'll continue to think about them for a long time.
Loretta Ross just won the MacArthur Genius Grant right before she came to present at the Chestnut Hill Harry Potter Academic Conference. So that was a great find. I don't know if other people also had Loretta Ross's talk as one of their favorites.
I did.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that was a favorite of mine. And just she said she kept dropping these kind of little golden bombs, you know, of insight. And I love that. One of them was, you know, what kind of like what Lana was saying about the conflation of identity and ideology. She said, don't fall into the trap of political cooties. You know, where you just cannot communicate with somebody because you cannot listen to somebody because you think that they have some identity or some ideology or both that gives them the cooties and you can't get near them, you know. So, and I do find in this, you know, current landscape, you know, you do end up thinking like that. And another thing that she talked about was her own personal struggles with overcoming her abusers, overcoming her hatred and her fear and her sadness and of her own trauma at having been abused. But she said, you know, vulnerability can be a strength strategy. And I really had never thought about the ways in which we can leverage our vulnerabilities to open the lines of communication, which can only help and strengthen us if it's done well, and if it's done out of a place of real care and concern for the other person. So I thought those were really neat. Again, just like you said, Katie, it did feel a bit like church in the best kind of way.
And you know, she's both an activist and a professor now at Smith College, and so she says, I don't just talk the talk. Right. I'm walking the walk on this. Yeah, Lauren. Right.
There's a certain overlap, Emily, I think, to hearing you say it back with the conversations that Dumbledore would have with Harry about Voldemort's shortcomings, about the unwillingness to be vulnerable, to experience those things are part of the reason why he could probably never put his Horcruxes back together to become, right? Because remorse and vulnerability, all those emotions are ones that are threatening to the self if you're not prepared to, as you said, expand your soul, as one of you said, expand your soul.
Yeah, and right. I think about like Stan Shunpike and that, you know, Harry is like, I'm not just gonna, you know, try to kill Stan Shunpike because like he's a human being, you know, he just, that Harry himself has that ability to understand the humanness And in fact, I mean, I would say if we broaden out humanness to even creatures that aren't human in the Harry Potter series, I think that's one of his great gifts.
I'd like to give a little more context, if I could, for our listeners about why Loretta Ross was there and how this tied in to the conference, because I realize we haven't talked that much directly about Harry Potter in her talk. So she had come under fire because shortly after J.K. Rowling had made many comments that many felt were transphobic, there was a letter, I think it was in Harper's Magazine, that was signed by a number of writers and academics about freedom of speech, academic freedom, things like that. And Loretta Ross was one of the people who signed it. And I think many people viewed that letter as sort of a transphobic dog whistle because J.K. Rowling was closely associated with it. And it was right as there was a lot of backlash. So Loretta Ross, I think, got a lot of criticism as, oh, that means you support J.K. Rowling and her transphobia because you signed the same letter. And she had barely even been aware of what was happening with that at the time. And so she said, like, she is not like a Harry Potter scholar generally, but she kind of became tied in with this issue of, oh, you stand up for free speech, but does that mean people saying hateful things? And by signing this letter, you're, so she got what she called the political cooties, basically, of, well, you've become associated with this person who you've never met and you don't agree with, because she had this attitude. And I think, you know, there was some interesting points that she brought up about, some of which I agreed with and some of which I didn't agree with, to be honest, about, you know, how forgiving and how much effort we should put into conversations, because this idea of having conversations that she brought in, but also when to know when to disengage is not worth your time, I thought was really helpful.
Right, calling off. Right.
Yeah, some people you're not going to be able to get through to. I would say that people, fans, LGBTQ organizations have generally, especially early on, really did try to have a dialogue with J.K. Rowling about the things that she said and really did call her in. And I do think that effort was made and was not received well by her. But I think it was helpful to hear Loretta Ross talk about the different ways you, like, whether as an institution, as a scholar, as an individual, can try to cope with the things J.K. Rowling has said, the things other supporters of her may say, and based on the way that someone is presenting these things, whether or not they're just a bad faith actor or whether they're someone you can actually get through to, how to figure out how to approach those conversations. Because we're all in those conversations now all the time.
All the time, right?
Where people hear Harry Potter and they say, oh, are you transphobic?
Oh, you still read the series?
And you have to grapple with that. And where can you have a talk with someone? Or people say, oh, don't you love J.K. Rowling and everything she's doing for women? And you might have to say, oh, no, I am not okay with those things. And so you get all different sides where within this fandom that you have to grapple with, how can I have a conversation with someone about whether it's specifically transphobia, about it's how you engage with the series, all of those things.
Yeah, if I can jump in, because going back, Lori, to what you said about, you know, members of the trans community and allies really trying to have dialogue with her in the early days of this controversy, one of the most valuable things I thought Loretta Ross said was the advice she gave for what to do if you get called in, called out, called on, you know, how to respond, because it could have been, you know, I always feel like if J.K. Rowling would have listened to Loretta Ross and kind of gone through her checklist, like, things might have gone really differently. She said, you know, first of all, you thank them for bringing this to your attention, and then you acknowledge the critique and you say, okay, what I'm hearing you say is, you know, this is what happened, and then you turn it into a calling on them, a calling in on them. You check on them, you say, you know, how did this make you feel? How are you coping with this? You know, tell me more about your perspective. And I thought that those were really valuable pieces of advice that I certainly wish, you know, we would all have the grace to follow, you know, in those moments when someone calls us out.
Emily, that raises a question that I attempted to raise during her Q&A, which was, do you think it's possible to engage in the vulnerability needed to enact these principles that Loretta was speaking about in the public forum of Twitter? How can, when there is such a power differential and our only means of accessing the six of us in this room, our only means to access this person is on a very, very hyper public forum known for its nastiness. How can is it even possible to engage in these practices?
Right. And yeah. I definitely don't think Twitter is the right venue for anything like that.
I mean, I kind of believe that anything can happen anywhere, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, so I don't know why. You might get a bunch of trolls piling on you if you do, but that doesn't affect what you do on Twitter. It doesn't affect, mm-hmm. you know, and that's one of the things that really stuck with me that she said. I'm sitting here with my notes in front of me and enjoying them all over again. But she talked about how social media monetizes our conflict.
Yeah.
And then they laugh all the way to the bank, you know, and I'll be honest, I have been kind of slipping off of social media, you know, for several months now, but I'm now looking at my activity on it since the conference, and it's been very minor, very minimal. Like there's been a sharp decrease because I just think I'm just lying in the pockets of my oppressor on social media. I don't want to do that. You know, I don't want to do that. So to answer your question, I mean, I don't know why it couldn't happen on Twitter, but does that mean it's going to be met beautifully? You know, people are going to thank you for being gracious and humble and vulnerable? No, they're not. It doesn't, right. You can't be that on that platform.
That's a great question though, Lauren. I think that's a question that we really got to think about. Where is the public forum in our society today? And is it a forum that does allow for those human connections or not?
I mean, I was just about to say, it's interesting you bring up the word human, because I was going to say there's a certain dehumanizing effect to social media, isn't there?
Oh, yes. That,
especially Twitter, where you have very little, you know, the very short bits, and like you don't have a whole very, you know, detailed profile like you might have on Facebook, that you're really seeing someone without context of who they are. And I think that a lot of us would probably say that we've had more productive conversations about the same topics that we've tried to talk about on Twitter in person. When you're looking at someone as a whole individual, maybe you already know them, they're not a complete stranger, or you know a little bit more about them. And it's much easier, I think, to approach someone where you can hear someone's tone out loud and you can nod along or shake your head and have all these different cues, as opposed to when it's just back and forth on Twitter. And I think, you know, J.K. Rowling is one of those topics that it's like, do I even want to wade into this and try to have a conversation with someone about, no, why what she said was really harmful and continues to say is super harmful on, but like, why I still engage with Harry Potter? Is that something I can even do on Twitter? But I have had those conversations with colleagues, with friends of friends, you know, people I've just met at some kind of event or party or something. You can have that conversation much differently, I think, when you're not online.
I think that's a really good point, Laurie, and I never really have warmed up to Twitter for that reason. I think it is revealing that Twitter is Rowling's social media of choice, because I think it is really unforgiving, and it doesn't allow for that sort of depth and discussions. And Rowling generally behaves there in a way that's far more output than anything else. I mean, she's primarily tweeting. I don't know to what extent she's listening. I've felt for a long time that she seems to be kind of living in her own private echo chamber.
Yeah. So I think we'll even talk about this probably when we talk a little bit more about the special section that the conference provided on J.K. Rowling and the trans community. But Lana, you also said that you had really liked Patrick McCauley's talk. What resonated with you, you said, emotionally about his talk?
I think the part of that that really spoke to me was his discussion of the paradigm of a protege, an inexperienced protege, experiencing the mentor's death. He was talking primarily, of course, about Dumbledore, but he also mentioned Gandalf and Jesus in the discussion. He talked about interesting questions like, what could be worse than death? Which he said is typically, you know, the villain's perspective is, Voldemort's perspective is nothing could be worse than death. Mm-hmm. And as a sort of a counter to that, he talked about Sirius's admonition to Peter Pettigrew that you should die before you would consider betraying your friends in Prisoner of Azkaban, which is one of my favorite scenes still in the entire Harry Potter series. Then he talked a little bit about sacrifice. He talked about Dumbledore's question to Snape, what use can you be? And mm-hmm. I thought about that question a lot. He made the point, Patrick said, to live for something is a different form of sacrifice than to die for something. And he talked about Snape as an example at that point. I just found that presentation really interesting, partially because, again, I think my response to conference presentations and talks of that sort is usually academic and aesthetic sometimes. And with those two presentations in particular, it was much more emotional and spiritual. And I left both of those presentations feeling really inspired to think about my interaction with the world and with others.
Right. I also had that one on my list too. And I think that scene that's, I guess it's kind of a flashback scene with Dumbledore and Severus Snape, where Dumbledore is very hard on Snape, you know, rightly so, but then like calls upon him, you know, not to just end it, but turn it around and to live for the right things. And of course, then that's the decision Harry ultimately makes at the end of the book too. And I think it's a really, you know, it's a counter to depression in a way, that suggests, you know, you can, life is still worth living, even when you've done terrible things or when terrible things have happened. And, and that's maybe that kind of thinking could be an antidote to that.
Yeah. Like for those who've dealt with such severe trauma, I thought that was really resonant with that perspective.
Right. I think that's right. And I think a lot of what Patrick said about the experience of the mentor's death processed by an inexperienced protege, you know, a lot of what he said about Dumbledore as Harry's mentor also applies to Snape, because the way that that Snape evolves as a character is really pretty similar to a lot of things going on in Harry's life. But of course, Harry doesn't see that. You know, his perspective, it's a good example of the way that your perspective of an authority figure, or of anyone, I guess, can color your sense of that person's relationship to you. Mm-hmm. You know, I think, and I could talk at length about Laurie Kim's presentation on Snape, right, and reimagining Snape, you know, in the Boggart scene. I just really think Snape is one of Rowling's great achievements.
Mm-hmm. Such an interesting, complex character who makes us return to him over and over again. Well, Louise, let's bring you in to this conversation. What were some of your favorite talks at the conference?
Well, I'll take this in a little bit different direction. Now, of course, Snape, incredibly complex, permeates the entire series, so much to say about them. One of my favorites was actually Beth Sutton Rumsbeck's on Reg Cattermole.
Becoming Reg Cattermole.
Yes, and I must admit, this is one of the things I really love about the conference is when something very, very small, I mean, Reg Cattermole, not a major character. But when someone goes very in depth into a character that makes only a very minor appearance and yet unpacks so much meaning and relates that, and you just see how essential all of these minor characters are to moving the story forward, to moving the plot forward, and to just, you know, giving us what we love about Harry Potter. So I picked that one as one of my favorites. And I must admit, it had a bit of a personal connection. I think the first Potter essay I ever wrote was actually on the Cattermoles. It was years before I think it was probably predated the conference itself. And I don't know that I've ever even published it or posted it or any place like that. But I wrote a paper on the Cattermoles long ago, and it was just so nice to see that coming up. And at the risk of sounding like a bit of a suck up here, Katie, I really loved your talk on mirrors.
Oh, yay!
Maybe you can talk a little bit more about what you said, but, you know, again, that's a concept, you know, it's one of those things you hear the title and think, okay, how many times have people talked about mirrors in Harry Potter and mirrors and twinning and reflections, and what possibly new could there be in this talk? And of course, Katie, you provided us with tons of new ways to look at it. And I was really excited to hear that one as well.
Well, yeah, thank you, Louise. I'm glad that you liked it. I actually developed that idea out of one of our Potterversity episodes where we were talking about the Secrets of Dumbledore movie. And we were talking about the, you know, mirror dimensions and the mirrors. I think this was with Bee Groves, Emily, if you remember that. Mm-hmm. And it just kind of got me thinking a little bit. And I've been doing a lot of research into, you know, maps and mirrors and that kind of stuff. And then I was like, I'm going to look at Secrets of Dumbledore and I'm just going to see where the mirrors are. And they're everywhere in that movie, I think very intentionally. And I'll just say, you know, like one example, the one that blew my mind was like at the end, I was like, this is interesting what's happening with the closing credits. It's kaleidoscopes, which of course are made out of broken mirror fragments. And right. So I've worked that in thematically, but it was a way to try to understand Dumbledore. And I think that particularly that movie is trying to give us some insight into his personality, his growth as a character before we meet him in the Harry Potter stories. And I thought, you know, mirrors and magical mirrors and also like mirrors as personal foils or, you know, even expressions of yourself are really central to some of these major questions that J.K. Rowling is exploring. And I just had a really good time with that one. So I'm glad you like that, Louise.
I want to echo that, Katie. It was also one of my favorites. And I liked the way that you connected the concepts of seeing and knowing, and talked also about the kinds of things that Dumbledore does with light and dark, and connecting all of that with mm-hmm. Dumbledore's proficiency with transfiguration, which is a discipline that has captivated him from the time that he was a young man. So I also had that one really high on my list.
Oh, good. Yeah. And it made me think about Aberforth Dumbledore also. And I thought, you know, and I honestly had not given a lot of thought to Aberforth before the movie, but they make him very interesting as well in the use of mirrors between him and, you know, Credence or Aurelius. I think all of that's really, really interesting. So
I think that is too, and it's kind of prefigured in the final Harry Potter novel with the idea of the blue eye reflected in the little fragment of mirror, which turns out to be Aberforth's eye, not Albus's eye.
So the chapter in which we meet Aberforth in person, and he meets up with the children in Hogsmeade, he pulls them in, is called The Missing Mirror. And I think that's not just in reference to the missing other part of the mirror fragment that's a communication mirror, but also the missing mirror for Albus in the form of Aberforth. And so that to me was just, I definitely believe there are intentional layers of all this mirror imagery happening that's continuing in the Fantastic Beasts movie series, which was, I thought, you know, a sign that we should be paying attention to those movies, maybe.
Yeah, that's all good stuff.
Totally on the lighthearted end of the spectrum. I thought that Caitlin Harper's Quidditch stuff is always
so good.
Yeah, it was real good this year. I love talking about things that really make you rethink your sort of entire worldview. I loved that her main point was sort of like, you know, you might say Quidditch makes no sense, but does any sport make any sense? And it's like, I guess it doesn't. I guess it doesn't. It's just time and social agreement that this is what makes sense. And I thought that was delightful.
I really laughed a lot during that.
I did too.
I thought that was, I mean, I'm not a huge sports fan to start with, in terms of, you know, I don't watch a lot of basketball, football. I really couldn't care less about that type of stuff. And just hearing her talk about the fact that no muggle sports makes sense either. So it was very lighthearted.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, there was enough heavy stuff in this conference that having that, right. that Quidditch talk was really kind of a breath of fresh air.
Like still intellectually stimulating, but not one that makes your soul hurt a little bit afterwards.
Right. And Caitlin knows her sports so well. She's huge, you know, she's a player, she's a fan. And so she really told me things about sports and I was like, I did not know that sport works that way either. So there was clearly a depth of research and a depth of knowledge about sports, not just sports are all silly. She came from this as someone who loves sports and can still see how ridiculous and arbitrary many of them are. And the idea of like, you know, every sport has intentionally some kind of handicap. If you could only, like rugby would be easier if you didn't have to throw the ball backwards. But like, that's the whole point. Oh, soccer would be easier if you could use your hands, but... And so the same with like, all these ridiculous sports and Quidditch, like that's what makes it.
And the reason that those rules exist is because exactly what you said, Lori, it makes the game fun. And one of the things that was, this semester, I teach our history capstone and I had a history student who did a history of football, particularly looking at 1905, which was a year when there were like 19 high school football players, and must be high school and college football players, who died playing football. And I thought, wow. yeah, right, Quidditch. And the Triwizard Tournament and the deaths and all of that, and that expectation when you read that and you're like, that's not how sports should work or do work. But it's not been that long ago. And there were, and he talked about in his presentation how the, you know, there were a lot of people who were, you know, the various administrators at Yale or Columbia who were like, like, of course, there's a risk of tremendous injury and death. And that's what a sport is all about. And that's not been that long ago now. So I thought that was just a wonderful talk. I totally agree with you, Lauren.
Another thing I liked about that talk was the connection that Caitlin made between rules of sports and rules of society. Early on, she said that Rowling made the comment that when she invented Quidditch, she was thinking of the principles that hold society together. That was mm-hmm. a quotation. And so, you know, if it is true that the rules of sports seem capricious and sometimes even ridiculous, that implies that the rules that hold society together may sometimes be capricious and ridiculous too,
yes.
Or maybe that they only make sense within the context of a particular sphere.
For sure. Now, Laurie, what about you? Did you have other favorite ones?
I really enjoyed Mark Anthony Lewis's talk on the modern Prometheus, Severus yes. Snape, and the subtle science and exact art of techne. For one thing, I really like comparative works. I mean, my papers are always comparative because I talk about medievalism, so I enjoy hearing that with another work I'm quite familiar with. I'm a Frankenstein fan. I've read it multiple times, so that was interesting for me to hear him talk about Snape in comparison to Victor Frankenstein. Not a comparison I think I've really heard before. And I found that very interesting, the way he talked about, specifically he started from Snape's opening speech to Harry's mm-hmm. first class about the art of potion making, and compares this to some of the language in Frankenstein and some of what happens throughout, down to the death of the woman he loves or lusts after, or however you want to view what Snape's intentions towards Lily are, and you know, his own looking at the dark arts and how that compares to, you know, Dr. Frankenstein's creation. Mm-hmm. And he got into, you know, ancient Greece and this idea of techne and art, science, and ethics, and how these things all come together. And I found that really compelling and interesting, whether or not you're particularly familiar with Frankenstein. But as someone who does really like Frankenstein, it was an interesting way both to look at Snape and to look at Frankenstein.
Yeah, right. I agree. I love that one. Lauren, how about you? Any particular ones?
I mean, we talked about a lot of mine. I'm a big okay. Ron fan, so I loved Beth's Ron paper. But the David Martin is such a he's so much fun.
Yeah,
he is so much fun.
Yes.
And his Secrets and Lies, his deception in the Harry Potter novels one. I love that the conference is a space for a lot of folks to work out ideas they're thinking about. And so he sort of brought a very tidy draft of notes and said, I want to discuss this with people who are my people and figure out what we're seeing here as I puzzle through it.
Mm.
And I found it was a very thorough look at the different secrets, major secrets and lies in the books. And I think that we had a really productive conversation in the Q&A. To talk about what maybe could be his second book after the fail-safe ways to charm witches.
Sounds like he workshopped it.
Yeah, and I think we do see that a lot. Actually, Louise, something when you mentioned the Reg Cattermole paper or the Cattermole paper you wrote, I said maybe I was thinking that in maybe we should have an out of the archives panel next year, you know, where we all pull something that we wrote a million years ago. I know I have an essay from when I wrote when I was probably 12. That I have, and I could locate and pull out.
Oh, Lauren, that makes me feel better. I was going to say, some of us are too young to have written, you know, published Harry Potter work in the year 2003. But if we're counting things we wrote when we were 12, then
I'm afraid I was a bit older than 12 when I wrote that one. Yes,
still out of the archives, and it predates the conference. That might be a lot of fun. So
that would be fun.
I have a bit of an in with the conference people. I might be able to make that happen.
It was great. I enjoyed David's talk too. And of course it was a lot of fun. Of course, now everybody knows him as the superstar of the Hogwarts Tournament of Houses. Mm-hmm. He had a different presence on stage than he has had in previous years, but that was really great to see. It was funny because last year, 2021, I actually moderated the session that he spoke in, and I was the only one I think who knew that he had been on that show because I had been in the audience, and he was wearing his Hufflepuff sweater, and it was like, I want to tell people so badly, but I couldn't. Under confidentiality rules, but right. it was great to see him.
That was one of the online presentations that I really wanted to see, but didn't get a chance to. I think I was probably moderating because I moderated the session that I presented in, and I also wanted to mention from that session John Dunn's wonderful talk, Dunn. He gave this great talk about the Death Eaters and the ancient notions of eating death and the sort of hubris of the search for immortality. And it really resonated with me on a lot of levels. I told him, you know, I'm your target audience for this because I'm a religious studies person as well. But it made a whole lot of sense to me in terms of some of the things that J.K. Rowling as an author has been critiqued for, especially her portrayal of overweight people and the way she often portrays evil characters or unlikable characters as overweight, but I do think that there is this notion all wrapped up, and this even applies to the Christmas pig. And I got all excited in the Q&A because I was like, John, you have to read the Christmas pig because the evil character in there is the eater of all lost things, and that, you know, it's a demonic character who, you know, is just a constant consumer. And it's just an example of a really ancient notion that resonates in this, you know, late stage capitalist society that we live in a really kind of really interesting way. And I just enjoyed the heck out of John's. And I got to hang out with John a little bit too over the weekend and really enjoyed hanging out with him and hearing his perspectives.
Right. I think, you know, we always try to find future guests, and I feel like he's one of the many who are possible to come from that conference as well.
Yes, please. But
I want to say also, like, that whole first panel, I was like, wow, this is the first panel of the whole conference. And Lori, you were a part of that, and you talked about Peeves. This is another character who I think not many people talk about, and you related Peeves to other, you know, puckish characters, you know, the kind of jester or the fool. I really thought your talk was delightful in all the ways.
Oh, thank you. It's funny you bring it up because I literally forgot about it.
Did you?
Oh, wait, yeah, I presented. Oh, that was a fun paper to write. Yeah, people don't really talk about Peeves. So I you know, I was the first slot on the first day. So
that's a hard position to start in, but you started us off strong.
It's a blur from there. You know, at one point, Emily brought up my paper from last year on chess and games, and I was like, I have no recollection of this paper.
I try to call on you, and you're like, huh?
Oops. I clearly need to reread my own work, but I'm glad it stayed with you, Katie.
Yeah, and it was fun. It was another one that I thought was fun, and it made me think about, again, a minor character who's not even in the movies and why we do lose something when he is extracted, because he is playing actually a pretty important role there. This concludes part one of our two-part series on the 2022 Harry Potter Academic Conference. Many thanks to our guests, Lori Beckoff, Lauren Camacci, Louise Freeman, and Lana Whited, for joining us. And listeners, we hope you'll join us for the second part of this discussion and the next episode. But for now, I'll leave you with the words of Rubeus Hagrid, who reassured Harry as he was setting off for his own wizarding education. Hagrid said, "Don't you worry, Harry. You'll learn fast enough. Everyone starts at the beginning at Hogwarts. You'll be just fine. Just be yourself."
We hope you have enjoyed this episode of Potterversity. Send us your thoughts on the episode or propose ideas for future episodes by writing to potterversitypodcast@gmail.com. If you like the show, consider leaving a review on iTunes, and be sure to follow Potterversity on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Potterversity is brought to you by MuggleNet, the number one Wizarding World resource since 1999. Emma Nicholson is technical director, and the show is produced by Laurie Beckhoff. Our theme music is performed by The Towel, featuring Sean Elsburn, Scott Hacker, Travis Princey, Ashley Shepherd, and Emily Strand, and produced by Sean Elsburn. I'm your announcer, Dr. Sarah Brown.
We hope that you will join us for part two, but for now, class dismissed.